Let's get started. Welcome to our 258th edition of Europe Calling. I would like to extend a particularly warm welcome to our four interesting guests and the more than 1,000 registered participants from across Europe. A special thanks goes to Daniel Point and his team with whom we're organizing this event tonight. So tonight we'll be discussing Hungary with guests from Hungary and beyond, of course. So why are we doing that? Why that choice? In a little over 3 weeks, on April 12, Hungary will elect a new parliament, and at present, Viktor Orban and his party trailing in the polls. So after more than 20 years, he might lose these elections. So to debate today, we would like to hear a bit more how the election campaign is unfolding and what the current situation is, and what the scenarios are that are now conceivable, and of course, what the various outcomes would mean for Europe. So before we start, a few housekeeping announcements. We'll be speaking alternately in German and English. So should you require assistance, we have an excellent interpreter team who's very happy to work for you. And you can select a language via the small globe, the icon in the control bar. So back to German. And as always with Europe Calling, you can ask your questions and rate others' questions. We're using Slido for that, and you'll see the link in the chat shortly. So please don't hesitate to ask your questions and rate others' questions. So with over 1,000 registrations, this is the only way to ask the one question or the questions that are of great interest to you. Please add your name. It's so much nicer if you don't have to keep saying anonymous user. So we're recording this event and then you can listen to it as a podcast on YouTube. Just keep that in mind when you ask a question. So that's all for the announcements. Let's get started. It's our co-host, Daniel Freund, MEP, Member of the European Parliament, the Green Party, anti-corruption expert, AFET committee. Before he joined the parliament, 2019, he worked for Transparency International. So looking at the Greens, Viktor Orbán, Google, if you look for that on Google, Daniel Freund will show up as one of the first hits. I'm very happy that we're co-organizing the seminar. You have the floor, Daniel. Thank you so much, Max. Thank you for setting up this event. So less than 3 weeks, we'll see the most important elections in Hungary, not just for Hungary, but for the European Union as such this year. And Orban, as you said, has almost been in power for 20 years. It's actually 16 now, anyway. So he turned Hungary into an illiberal country, into a mafia state. And this has serious consequences for the people living in Hungary, of course, but then it has an impact on us, on all Europeans, because Orban vetoes and blocks so much. There's no other nation or no other leader who uses their veto rights as much. So support for Ukraine will not happen. We've had another veto by Orban at the summit just recently. So it's just to say that this election is very important for all of us. I was actually on the ground. Last Sunday, we had a major march. It was basically the summit of the campaign with Orban and the opposition leader. And actually, it's the first time in years that in the polls, Orban is not leading. And Peter Magyar, head of the opposition, could be a good alternative. For many years, he actually was very close to the leaders within Fidesz, within Orban's party. And then 2 years ago, he said, "No, thank you. I'll leave the corrupt system. I'll fight the system." And he founded a counter movement. So this is basically the context of these elections. So I'd like to share something that I experienced last weekend. It's just so much contrast. So just a quick anecdote. I was in Felcsőd, a small village, and this is the place where Viktor Orban grew up. And actually there, it's very clear how his system works. Actually, there's a number of very absurd EU projects run there, and Orban is going to buy an old and ancient Habsburg villa after another. This will be turned into luxury hotels, golf grounds, and they are owned by his father, his friends or sons, and the family members. So they amassed so much money, his family and friends, 80 billion that have flown into Orbán ever since 2010, ever since he took over. The guess is that about 20 billion euros were stolen. They went into his own pockets. They've disappeared. And looking at those luxury castles on the one hand, and then you leave Budapest in a small place called Monó, with about 600 inhabitants, the Roma. And basically, these are the amongst the poorest in the country. There's no infrastructure. These are people who do not have running water in their homes. So the poorest in the EU, no roads to speak of. So these are the very regions, the outermost regions that should have benefited from EU funds. This is what the structural funds of the European Union are there for. That's the very point, to provide a better life for these people, constructing infrastructure. But the money does not go to these people. It goes into others' pockets. It's used to cut down on the rule of law and democracy in that state. So this is the context we're looking at for the elections. I'm very happy that we can chat about that tonight. So we have people here who know the situation very well.
Daniel, für diese für dieses Scene Setting oder genau, die Bühne aufzubauen.
Thank you very much, Daniel, for setting the scene. And we shall now be hearing from Marta Pardavi and from Judith Zeisler and from Daniel Hegedus, how we deal with Hungary, how we interpret the situation, and then Anton will be closing up, giving us the perspective from Germany. And I look forward now very much to announcing Marta Pardavi. She's the co-chair of the Human Rights and Rule of Law NGO Hungarian Helsinki Committee and has worked with them for a long time and can really explain very, very well how Viktor Orban dismantled the rule of law in Hungary. I'm very happy to welcome you back to the webinar of ours, and there you go.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I am very happy to be back in this webinar to talk about something that affects us Hungarians, obviously, very directly, but I think every European, and maybe even beyond, is going to be indirectly somehow touched by what happens in Hungary in a few days, in about 3 weeks. Daniel, friend, you talked about the personal enrichment of Hungary's political leader and how European Union funds and public Hungarian taxpayer funding has been used to achieve the enrichment of a very close circle. But we have to ask ourselves, how is that possible when Hungary is a member state of the European Union, where we have institutions, we have citizens, we have a political structures, we have a society that should be able to protect against this kind of graft, this kind of privatization of public funds? And we also have to ask ourselves now, a few weeks before the elections, in the event that there is a regime change in Hungary, which I would not be certain of it at all, but in that event, how much can be reversed? And this is, of course, as I said, most important to us Hungarians, but it has repercussions for everybody. Now, when we talk about how in the past 16 years, through four government cycles, this has happened, we have to really see that this is not about one policy, one scandal, one incident, one story, but it is really an overarching systemic transformation. And this is why we need to really think about how a systemic reforms can gut a democracy, gut the rule of law, and whether they can build them back. So this deliberative, deliberate systemic transformation that has happened in Hungary has been achieved through a variety of very sophisticated, mostly technical, legal means, but with a big dose of propaganda and media distortion to aid it. Mr. Orbán has created what is often called the system of national cooperation. This is, I would juxtapose it, I would put it against the system of checks and balances. Normally, in a liberal democracy, you would have institutions, the branches of government, that make sure that no one can go ahead and exert power arbitrarily in a non-transparent manner. But what has happened in Hungary is that the executive branch really dominates all other branches of government, so the judiciary, the legislation. But also, this majoritarian rule has meant that the external checks on power have been also weakened. So, civil society, the media, even academia, culture, the arts have been weakened. And external checks on power also are being at least targeted and attacked. So, we can see how the European Union has taken a very long time to respond to this democratic and rule of law erosion in Hungary. And once the tools, the famous toolkit, has been developed, there is a constant pressure, a constant testing, a constant challenging of whether these tools are legitimate, whether they are democratic, whether they're lawful. So there is this dynamic of push and pushback, and we will see how this unfolds after April 12. Now, this system of national cooperation really is one where the classic rule of law has been replaced by what often is termed as the rule by law, but we could also say it's rule by political discretion. Discretion that is not predictable, not transparent, not subject to checks and balances, and which has affected state institutions in Hungary, but also institutions of society, such as civil society or the media or academic institutions, cultural institutions. That together make up the democratic fabric of society. What this means is that it's not composed of isolated measures, but a coherent system where stigmatization measures are targeting dissidents or journalists or those who hold government accountable. This can actually affect groups, for example, very grassroots, small civil society groups who are concerned about pollution, environmental harm of factories. This can mean that journalists who are exposing in the last few days, for example, the Hungarian leading government figures' complicity with Russian leading politicians or political actors. They are being targeted through a variety of ways. First, in the first few years, we experienced this more in the narrative space, in messaging, in smear campaigns, but then partly inspired by examples in Russia and elsewhere in autocracies, we have seen how legislation was adopted in Hungary to actually target certain groups, either those such as civil society organizations which work on democracy and rule of law, or groups of members of our own community, of our own society, who are belonging to minorities. This has meant migrants, refugees, also LGBTQ plus community members, the Roma, but also others such as teachers or doctors. Or other professional groups, unions, who have been raising their voice about their labor conditions or the impossibility of providing good services for the public. Now, these institutions have been eroded, but what is very important is whether you can go to court to challenge this. So the court system and the ability of judges, individuals, and the court system as an institutional structure is a key issue here. And we have seen how, through a variety of ways, the judicial independence is at least under pressure in Hungary. Still today, after so many years of struggle, We see that certain judges at the highest court are very, very keen on keeping their integrity, of keeping up respect for the law, and often this is by using European Union legal standards. These judges and the entire idea of judicial independence is, of course, always under threat. This is still a an area where I don't think it's a done deal, and we see quite a lot of integrity, of willingness to challenge an overarching power, even when individual judges might be at the risk of, for example, losing their jobs or losing their court positions. Now, another thing that is, I think, gives us a lot of concern is not only the legislative steps that have been taken, but how laws themselves have been become fragile through, for example, the use of extraordinary judicial, extraordinary legislative tools, such as enacting a state of danger. This is where the Hungarian government can rule by decree. This has been the case since basically the beginning of COVID. Since 2020, the Hungarian government is able to put aside legislation and create government decrees in a very opaque, wide-ranging manner. This has been used over 1,200 times already, very often without any connection to the underlying purported danger that this scheme is supposed to protect us Hungarians against. And I think Judith will mention how this has been used particularly to rein in economic actors and to create economic asymmetries even further. Now, of course, this has a huge impact on citizens. I've mentioned certain minority groups, they're obviously affected, but what this has done to Hungarian society, I think, is to distill a sense of disappointment or disillusionment with democracy. This really rides on disillusionment, particularly when people don't see public sector delivering for them. But what it has also meant is that there's a general perception, perhaps, that outcomes, achievements, success will depend on political connections and not on the legal framework, not on your merit. That institutions are no longer neutral, but they serve to carry out the will, the discretion of a political elite, a clique that has captured the economy, that has captured a lot of our mind space, in fact. And this means that people often, but not always, will self-censor. They will use the anticipatory obedience, thinking, second-guessing what the power expects them to do. And this will, of course, dampen potentially resistance. And at the same time, while this situation has been ongoing for 16 years, I'm quite heartened to see that civil society in certain pockets has actually grown stronger, that there is independent media outlets that are doing excellent work to uncover, for example, exactly the high-level corruption that Daniel Freund has spoken about, that there is artists and academics who continue to do what they're meant to do, who actually have built up structures and muscles of resilience that will be something that both Hungarians and also Europeans can look to and gain inspiration and experience from. So the pushback is also possible, and this is where I think international attention, particularly in the European arena, has been very, very key to support, to give yes, moral support, but also financial support. And some of that is, of course, achieved through the EU budget. Maybe we'll talk about how support for democracy, rule of law, and civil society will become very, very important in the next one. And so to close, what I'd like to say is that this is really a structural transformation This is a system that is designed to entrench power. And so it will be a key question after April 12, how this will either progress or regress, and how civil society, citizens themselves, can participate in this, because it will be ultimately up to us individuals, voters in Hungary, to make that change. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was extremely clear and extremely interesting and eye-opening. And I think you also made a perfect transition to Judith Zeisler, who is head of public policy at Transparency International Hungary. And as you all know, that you probably know what Transparency International is doing, but they are tirelessly, not only in Hungary, documenting and exposing corruption and the economic damages and impact corruption has on economies and on the people. And that's why Judith is here, and we are really looking forward to what you have to say.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for the invitation and for organizing this very timely discussion. I will try to summarize the answer to this complex question very briefly. What I find very interesting about the issue is the contradiction that the current political system in Hungary is based on the misappropriation of EU public funds, as Marta and Daniel already mentioned, while its messaging is directly precisely against these EU values. And probably before I explain the major patterns of misusing public funds, it is worth to take a step back and to explain a bit the specific nature of Hungarian corruption that Marta already mentioned a bit, which is called state capture. And state capture describes a process by which a private interest group systematically dismantles the institutions designated to hold power accountable and redirects the apparatus of the state to serve the enrichment of those in power rather than the public interest, the public good. And this is what's happening currently in Hungary. And all in all, this is a very top-down form of corruption that undermines fair competition. So back to EU funds, it is important to admit that since its accession in 2004, Hungary has been a beneficiary of EU funds, which means that it received more funding from the European Union budget than it contributed. Overall, since Hungary joined the EU, the country has received more than 67 billion euros in EU transfers. So Hungary's average annual GDP growth would have been just minimalistic or zero without this EU support. In other words, EU funds were really the engine of Hungary's development. However, on the other side, sadly, it has been not only the engine of the development, but this dependence had a direct political implication, as the Hungarian state capture is really built on the systematic diversion of these public resources. These funds allowed to pursue an aggressive redistribution of economic assets toward a network of politically aligned businesses. And if I could choose one symbol of this misuse of funds, that would be probably the so-called treeless canopy walkway, which might be perhaps known by some of the public as well. And it's really widely known in Hungary as well. This construction was built in a small village in eastern Hungary, near Martonfalva, which is a municipality of around 2,000 people. And there, the Fidesz-backed mayor won an EU grant to construct a canopy walkway on his own land. However, after building this construction, he chopped the trees, he cleared the entire forest around the canopy walkway, and he sawed the timber. And the whole 80-meter long wooden walkway stood in an open farmland. So it really became a symbol of misusing EU funds. And which made it also a symbol that a lot of complaints was already made to several national and international authorities. However, even if investigations were already started, no one has yet been arrested in this case, even if it happened more than 3 years ago. And this case was not even isolated. TI Hungary and the investigative journalists identified several comparable constructions, such as looking towers or ruined bicycle passes built with EU funds, which means that several EU-funded investments resulted in poor quality, unfinished or unnecessary projects, and which were often very overpriced. However, even if the canopy walkway is a very understandable, easily understandable, and photographic symbol of the misuse of EU funds, corruption schemes are far more complex, pricey, and abstract in Hungary. Let me explain a bit those. Of course, one of the obvious channels of diverting public funds in Hungary is public procurement. One of these signs, the signs of misusing the tenders, were single bid tenders, were the high proportion of single bid tenders for a long time, which were targeted and by the conditionality mechanism milestones. They were reduced since 2023. However, single bid tenders is not a silver bullet for promoting fair competition in Hungarian public procurement, as the number of bidders can be easily inflated through sham bids. On the other hand, government-linked actors such as the childhood friend of the prime minister continued to win the highest value contracts. And the public procurement market remained really concentrated. According to TI Hungary's monitoring, the biggest actors, the biggest three actors, won more than 25% of all the contracts, all the tenders from 2021 to 2023. In the meantime, the widespread use of the so-called framework agreements enabled to monopolize several sectors in Hungary, such as cleaning or IT, or even the very propagandistic state communication, where one single actor won more than 70% of all the tenders. Other public contracts, such as the development of highways and waste management, were dominated by concessions, which were concluded for extremely long time, 35 years. In these cases as well, TI Hungary filed also complaints and infringement proceedings were launched by the European Commission. However, these concessions still operate these systems. Another way of very complex use of funneling public funds to the political elite is the use of private equity funds. The specificity of these structures is that for the moment, the identity of the investors remain hidden. In these cases, TI Hungary identified that the Hungarian state channeled more than 3.5 billion euros of public money into these private equity funds, often together with unknown co-investors, while most of these funds were usually managed by companies which were owned by crony businessmen, such as, for example, the son-in-law of the prime minister. Through these channels and in many other ways, over the 16 years, politically connected insiders turned modest assets into billions euro fortunes. And they are not shy about showing off all these fortunes. The childhood friend of the prime minister, who is also the most frequent winner of public contracts and the richest person in Hungary, grew 200 times richer during the last 10 years of the Orbán era. His fortune grew faster than the owner of the Facebook empire, Mark Zuckerberg. Daniel has already mentioned that the prime minister's family owns the manor of the Hetvanpuszta, the so-called Hungarian Versailles as well, which is a gigantic Habsburg era manor with pools and cigar rooms and banquet kitchen, the prime minister's father was also a subcontractor in a second degree to some public procurement project. And we can also mention his son-in-law, who doubled his fortune to almost 45, sorry, 460 million euros after an EU fraud investigation. Which found irregularities of 43 million euros. That was the famous Elias case, where no investigation and no prosecution was happened, sorry, either in this case. So sadly, the misuse of public funds rarely result in any consequences in Hungary. As the government has progressively subordinated the key oversight institutions, such as the prosecution service, numerous high-profile corruption cases go unpunished in Hungary. And it's important to mention that Hungary isn't a member of the European Public Prosecution Office either. So it was really a crucial step and the very last moment when in December 2022 the European institutions suspended and tied to conditions Hungary's access to EU funds under various procedures due to severe breaches of the rule of law. The so-called conditionality regime was applied for the first time in the EU history in Hungary. And until the fulfillment of these conditions, the EU blocked the allocation of about 19 billion euros of cohesion and RRF, Recovery and Resilience Facility funds for Hungary. While so far, as regards to anti-corruption measures, the implementation of the commitments is far from being carried out at the right pace. On the other hand, the F.
I think
Sorry,
we
is.
sorry, don't, I know you can carry on. This is a bad
Yeah,
thing.
sorry.
You can carry on forever with that, but just in the interest of time. So if you come to a close, please.
Yeah.
But
So
take
yeah,
your
I just had,
sentences.
yeah, okay. So I can also admit that the elections might be a turning point of escaping from this state capture of a more European way, to a more European way of operating. However, to the work of dismantling embedded networks and restoring institutional independence and recovering frozen EU funds will be both technically complex and politically contested. So even if there is a change in the political system, a decade and a half of institutional erosion can be erased overnight. Thank you. And I would be glad to take questions.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we'll definitely have tons of questions. As I said, it's like it's if it wasn't so bad, it would actually be funny. I mean, all the ways that this money, this walkway, and I just posted in the chat actually the link to the report. Like, if it wasn't that bad, it would actually be funny. But it's actually horrible. The list, you can go on and on and on with the things that's happening. So, I think what you did and Marta now did, they're kind of showed the problem and described that very, very well. And now we turn to Daniel Hegedus.
Jetzt ganz neu, noch gar nicht so lange
To continue with Daniel Hegedus, he's pretty recent deputy director of the IEP, Institute for European Politics. And he will now answer the question, who, these elections, who is contending? And how do the surveys work? How do the polls work? And perhaps it can help us understand what's happening. So, Daniel, you have the floor. Thank you so much, Max. Okay, I've got 6 minutes. I'm not sure that's going to work, but thank you so much for having me. It's an honor, it's a privilege to speak to you here. And as Max explained, I was asked to speak in German. Good to do so. And then my presentation, well, it'll say a few words about the election system and also about the challenges looking at those elections. So I'll try my best to keep it nice and short, nice and brief. So allow me to show a presentation. I'll try and share that. Can you see the presentation? I think we'll have to enlarge it and then actually, yes. Yes, we have it. We have it all here.
Ich würde damit anfangen, dass eigentlich in den letzten 2 Jahren haben wir eine ganz.
So looking back at the last 2 years, we have seen a fundamental restructuring of the landscape of political parties. So a multi-party system and a fragmented opposition. That was the past. And that has changed over the past 2 years. We've seen a major change. The opposition party has gained votes. It was the former Fidesz politician, Peter Magyar, who founded this party, Tista. And it basically sort of absorbs a majority of the opposition. And, those voters who weren't sure who to vote for and those who've always voted for the opposition, they were bundled, so to see. So basically it's a competition between two large parties. So it's not a tripartite, but a two-party system. So there is a fairly small party, a right extremist, I really have to say, also measured against Germany. They actually make it into parliament, be it with a minority, but this right extremist political party could get a major role, major weight when it comes to coalition negotiations. But the campaign, the election campaign as such, is run between those two major parties. So how does Peter Magyar react and how does he think he can master this challenge? And how did he manage to get this far within 2 years? Basically, change the system, turning it into a two-party system and reunite, if you like, the opposition. So the two previous speakers explained that what he managed to do was to address strategic corruption and moral corruption. And this is something, that strongly concerns Orban. This is the way people see him. The economy is faring badly, faring worse. There's a lack in public services, and also the standard of life in general is getting lower. And Magyar managed to show this to people. So this was not like that before 2024. The political analysts in Hungary had just one rule that basically no Hungarian voter would be interested in corruption or anti-corruption. This is not a subject with which you can win elections. So this is a political innovation, really. what we see here. And this is reflected in today's campaign between a rather future-oriented party, a campaign that looks at what is at people's heart. We've got the Spectrum for Freedom t-shirt. And then we have that group that is confronted with fear and lies and anger. This is what the Fidesz governing party is counting on. So that's the other extreme. So since 2014, Fidesz always focused their campaigns on external enemies. This contrast in political communication between the two political parties become very clear. So the main message is a very fundamental one. So what has that got to do with the integrity of the elections? So one thing is pretty sure. Hungary had its last free and fair elections quite a while ago, 16 years ago, 2010. Ever since 2014, all elections were considered rigged by OSCE and ODIHR. So they were called free but not fair. I'm not going to give you the full list, extensive list, save some time, but looking at institutionalized and systemic advantages that Fidesz takes, especially looking at their dominating the media system with their campaign. So it's institutionalized, the benefits they retrieve with their campaign and the attention by the public, which has led to the fact, and this is mentioned in all reports, even in the 2023 OSCE report on the elections, what we see here is an overlapping between the party and the state. So it just goes to show that the party manipulates things in their way to their benefit. But then again, what also comes to light in the survey results is the following: these systemic advantages that may have been an advantage in terms of votes and also support by voters. That may well be the case, but then it's changing. And today we see a different picture. And what we also see is that support, the opposition party Tisha, is something that does show up in the media. So it actually managed to neutralize the overwhelming effect of Viktor Orban's party using effective communication. So Tisha, the opposition, touches upon subjects that are important, that are at voters' hearts. And this way of communicating to voters, this could be very decisive, looking at the results of the surveys. The systemic advantages that Fidesz had seen, the ruling party giving the election system first past the post, they were quite tangible with the compensation for the winner. But Tisha is more or less the largest party, so this could bring benefits, this could bring an advantage to today's opposition party, Tisha. So I think the election result really is open. And looking at opinion research, opinion surveys, it becomes clear that the petition party does have a good chance to win these elections with a stable majority. That's a big if here in capital letters, if these elections will remain free. So it's the first time ever since 2010 is the major question. The key question is not whether the election will be fair. They will not be fair, that is for sure. But this could not prevent the opposition party from winning. The real question, the crux of the matter, is that whether we will have free elections, and or whether Prime Minister Orban will go towards authoritarian measures to stay in power. So this is just to say there's quite a toolbox, an authoritarian toolbox for Orban that he can use, and also that there are dynamics to escalate things. So we might witness this in the coming 3 weeks up until the elections. So first of all, it was actually covered quite well also in international media, the fact that ever since the end of January, a high-ranking Russian military delegation, the security service, is in Budapest. So this would be staff of military that was used last year as well, last time around with elections, responsible for manipulation, if you like, and rhetoric. So we have a difference here. It's an intervention they were invited for. In Romania and Moldova, what we've seen is external voting manipulation, which happened against the state power. This is the kind of resistance that we can only expect in a much weaker form. That is to say, the institutions in a sovereign state should try and prevent such an intervention, but they're under the surveillance of the political leading party. So we can't exclude this from happening. So looking back at the elections in 2018, things were not free and fair, irregularities. So this is basically the blueprint, if you like. So we cannot exclude that we will see these irregularities on the voting day, and that this might influence the results of the vote. We cannot exclude that we will see false flag operations in the coming 3 weeks and intervention of that kind. Let me point to the Washington Post report. Based on information from security services, they had received information that Russian services have planned a false flag attack, or might plan this attack against Prime Minister Viktor Orban to influence the momentum and change the momentum during these elections. This is something we cannot exclude. What we've seen in the past 2 to 3 weeks, it's getting pretty close to that. Escalation with Ukraine, just to mention one. The government's communication and the campaign is nearly solely focused on the external threats to the system, for example, energy security reaction by Ukraine, what that would mean for Hungary and energy supply. 1.5 weeks ago, we've seen hybrid warfare measures like that taking place in the Hungarian campaign. So Hungarian special forces, they were supposed to accompany a money transport throughout Hungary, and they were taken hostage, or this is what they said anyway. And it was said that this would be money to support Tisza, the opposition party. That was the claim. And unfortunately, we cannot exclude that that Viktor Orban might react as an autocrat, and the manipulated elections will be blamed on Ukraine and on the EU. And this is a narrative that politicians close to the leading party have been mentioning a lot. So whatever the measures we'll see, whatever's going to happen, I think these are pretty plausible scenarios given the context that we see now in the election campaign. And European and international partners should be prepared for that. And finally, it's actually shameless self-marketing. Let me say, last Friday, our institute published a scenario analysis, and the German version will be available in the coming days, I hope. So let me just advertise something here from our institute. the political scenarios with major impact, with a major impact on the European Union. So I really recommend you check our website for this contribution. But let me end here. Thank you very much. It's great to have this opportunity, and I'm looking forward to your question. Well, shameless self-advertising, this is what we want you to do here. This is why the link, will you find a link in the chat? Thank you very much. So you're happy to receive all links to read more in depth. Thank you very much. That was very clear and pretty frightening. So invited interventions by the Russian Secret Service. This sounds really absurd. It's something that's very hard to imagine. So this really ties in well with our last contribution before we start the Q&A. Anton Hofreit, he is a German member of Parliament of the Greens and head of the Committee for European Affairs in the Bundestag. And he's always been very vocal on supporting Ukraine at the moment when there were not many voices. So this actually ties in nicely with what Daniel said. So Tony and your team, thank you so much for supporting this webinar. Thank you so much for helping us, for supporting us. So we're looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for organizing this webinar. So just very interesting to hear, and indeed quite shocking. So the question you asked was that what the German government should do given the situation. So given the situation, I believe they should become active in three areas: better preparation and agreement with the European partners, and also the question what's going to happen after April 12th. We've heard the scenarios. And then the federal government should put much more pressure on Hungary to use the rule of law instruments. And what is more, the German federal government should have a good plan how to deal with the fact that Orbán is no longer using his position as a member of the European Union, but more as a Putin agent or an agent, a spy for China. So basically, the business base is lost, and this is where Article 2 comes in. Then again, in the past, the government has not actually done enough. So last time, last 12th of April, our government had little on their hands. But what should they do? Now, should this authoritarian scenario happen, as we just heard from Mr. Hegedus, so even before the election night, Orbán declares himself the winner, and it is clear that those were rigged elections. Putin will congratulate him. Oh, great, Orbán has won the elections, and anybody who claims anything else works hand in hand with the with Ukraine or others who falsely claim to have won the election. So it's really important to join hands as a German government with other governments so that we declare we do not accept, we do not recognize the result of the election, also no longer invite Orbán to any European events, summits, etc., that he doesn't even get access to the European Council building. So this is something that cannot be prepared within 1 or 2 minutes or 1 or 2 hours. This is something that the governments need to prepare for. That is the European Commission jobs, but also the member state job. It's their responsibility, and it's hardly happening. We had a written request wanting to know what does the German government do? And basically, just to translate it into simple words, well, it doesn't do anything. Now, rule of law, Daniel Freund mentioned that 80 billion received by Hungary from the European Union. From those 80 billion, 25% were probably misappropriated, and those that were not misused were flew into a canopy walkway without trees around. So basically, this is misappropriation. This is misuse of these funds. So let's just compare. Germany pays its share to the European Union budget. So to be harsh, well, actually, Orbán put 5 billion euros of German taxpayers into his pockets. So what we also heard is that we should take stricter measures. We never hear what's happening to this money. It's not just European taxpayers' money or Hungarian taxpayers' money. It's about German taxpayers' money. So I don't want to be acting like a nationalist here, but if the German government doesn't think they're responsible for German taxpayers' money, I'm not sure what they feel responsible for. So let me also add that Orbán and his regime is no longer, hasn't been for a long while, on Europe's side. It's not just about vetoing the 90 billion loan that is very important for Ukraine's security, for our security, and the package of sanctions. And it's just not very surprising. What we've read publicly now is that the Hungarian foreign minister or ministers, Orbán himself maybe, have actually talks with Moscow discreetly during summits. And to accept that is, means that you or that we accept treason. So here the German government should take a much clearer stance. But the question is, how do we do that? You know, how can we speak a very clear-cut language of power? And Merz, our chancellor, always says that the German government or the European Parliament, there's nothing that would hinder them, that would prevent them to support the rule of law. And no one would prevent the government to use the Article 7 procedure, or that a stance is taken at the Council. The Council, you keep getting the impression that the German government acts diplomatically, like in the 15th, let's be nice to one another, we're all heads of government. But the European Union is much more than just a meeting, getting together of states that happen to be close to one another, that happen to be neighboring states geographically. There is a treaty, and there are certain criteria and conditions we have agreed on. And if a country pockets 80 billion euros as a member, then they will have to keep to the conditions, to the criteria, and they have to stick to the rules. And that is not to communicate any talks to an enemy country during summits and meetings. And this is something that should be the German government's job together with other pro-European democratic countries. There must come an end to that. And if then Orbán or his foreign minister is no longer invited because they commit treason, well, they're not invited anymore. It's actually not the European Union that's to blame here. There's simply the foreign minister to blame who, because he sent all relevant information to Lavrov, from what we know. So this is something that no community needs to accept. But really, you know, you need to call a spade, and then take action. Thank you very much.
I'm switching
Thank
into
you very
English
much
actually now
indeed.
for the Q&A, so we all directly understand each other. We have many, many questions, and we have exactly half an hour. We are perfectly on time, but it will be still be tricky to answer all the questions. But I will try to combine them a bit. And some of the things the people here in the audience ask have already been answered, but I will still kind of try to make it transparent. So we'll start with the questions, you know, that most people gave a like. And remember, you could give a like here on Slido, and if you haven't done so, try it as well. So Matthias Berg here has the very first and the top question. So He asks, are there any initiatives, and if so, how successful are they to expel Hungary from the EU, prosecute the Orbán family and put them behind bars and give the money to the Hungarian people, or alternatively bring it back to Brussels? So there are actually three questions, I would say. I mean, in terms of, Tony has said a bit about the rule of law conditionality in terms of giving money back, prosecute the Orbán family as well. But maybe so it's like, maybe it's a, I will we'll give that question probably to the round, and it will give you an opportunity for all of you just to respond to it in generally how, how successful the fight back has been. And we will do this, the whole Q&A session, maybe just a little explainer for the panel. You can also raise your hand with the hand symbol here on the panel. You can do that too. So we'll just do that, because if a question has already been answered sufficiently, you don't have to just repeat what the previous people have said. So we just do this and be very interactive here. So again, so the top question here was by Stefan: are there any initiatives, and if so, how successful are they to expel Hungary from the EU? One, prosecute the Orbán family. Two, and put them behind bars. It's 2.5, and give the money to back to the Hungarian people. So we have Daniel Freund with a hand here.
I will speak German, however. First of all, to exclude Hungary from the European Union is a question that is frequently raised. It has been proposed by several parties. To be honest, I regard this as the wrong way forward. I have never contemplated that, because I think it is too much linked to the person of Orbán. You would really penalize the whole nation of Hungarians just because of that one head figure. And I think it is important to make sure that the Hungarians would be able to participate in the European Union. They would really lose many, many liberties and freedoms. And I think that's wholly unfair and really not justified. And I think the way forward must be to exert pressure on this particular government in order to pull them back into the reins of the EU conditions and rules. Now, whether or not the Orbán family can be brought to justice, that's a different question altogether. And to reclaim funds that were misappropriated, that came from the European Union, would probably best be clarified if Hungary became a member of the European Prosecutors an organization. And Maria has promised that he would accede this body. I would be a little more optimistic, but under Orban himself, of course, this will never materialize, because we need independent organizations. I think he would, Orban himself would not let this happen. It really needs different structures for that.
Thank you, Daniel. Anyone else from the panel want to respond? And if not, just carry on with the next question, because we do have many. And this is another question here by Sabine, regarding what Tony already said and what Daniel said about, the Hungarian foreign minister reporting directly, essentially, closed door information to the Russian foreign minister Lavrov. So, and the question by Sabine here is, what measures are being taken to address this? Is this an act of espionage, or does it amount to high treason? And I want to extend the question also to our Hungarian friends. So how is that specific case perceived by the Hungarian population. So we have a hand from Tony, and we'll let Tony answer first. But maybe Marta or Daniel or Judith, anyone who feels most responsible. So how is that viewed in Hungary? This very strong, whatever that is, you may be a judge for that. So Tony, and then Marta, and then Daniel.
Thank you very much. I can only answer the first part of the question. Well, it's only become officially known because Tusk said a few days ago that he wasn't surprised at all, and it would have to be clarified what it really means, because it's only come out into the open a few days ago. And I think it's immensely important for Antonio Costa and the European Council to take this up and to take decisions. Of course, we will have to analyze what it means legally, because maybe some of it is even legal. It all depends. But if it is really true that the council does not have the rules to label information, then they really need to work on that, and then certainly this particular foreign minister should not be invited to the foreign ministers' council meetings any longer, and something will need to be done to avoid information being leaked and siphoned off to adversaries. But this apparently happened for years and years. Yeah, well, it would really be interesting to hear the journalists on that. Marta.
Thank you. I'd like to address this issue of a foreign interference in the electoral context, which is something that is happening right before our eyes. There seems to be a pattern of interference by Russia in Hungary's government, ministries, in our social media, in our campaign landscape altogether. This is, of course, something that has happened before in other countries, and for sure it will happen in many other countries. So every election is prone to this. It's a key vulnerability. The question here is whether the institutions that are meant to identify these risks, to respond to them, to take action against them, to prevent and to respond, whether they're equipped to do it, and whether they're willing to do it, and whether they are capable of acting true to their mission rather than true to a political convenience or discretion. And this is a key issue in the Hungarian context. Now, what came out, of course, about discussions in the European summits is brand new information. So I think it is early to see how Hungarian authorities, agencies will be responding, but one has doubts about their appropriateness of their response. What we see is that the messenger, the journalist Szabolcs Panyi, who is excellent and has built a very high level of credible reputation, is being attacked. He was in fact apparently surveilled again after being subjected to Pegasus spyware surveillance for a significant period of time in a few years ago. But this is also a phenomenon that is known in Hungary, and it appears that those who should have done something about it are not doing something about it. Why that is? Why is this tolerated? Is this on invitation? Or is it just simply that the Hungarian authorities and the government ministries that have a responsibility under our constitution to prevent it and to take action against it are looking the other way? This is going to be, I think, one of the key questions now in the last few weeks of the elections. Our organization, when we talk about the electoral landscape, the context, We've been, of course, as a Helsinki organization, focused on also on fair and free elections and cooperating with the election observation missions from the OSCE, for example. We've been identifying pressures on on election integrity for many years, but I did not anticipate that Russian interference would be escalating to this level. We prepared a variety of papers, and I will put it in the chat, and perhaps Max, you can share it with the audience, that looked at a certain array of examples, and we point out how, for example, and Tony Hofreiter, you as a parliamentarian, I think will be very upset to hear this. The Hungarian Oversight Committee, the National Security Committee, has basically so far refused to really look into this. It has not discussed the matter at length. It hasn't instructed the political or government leaders responsible for these issues to appear before it and to explain what is happening. So literally, it is as if they are tying their own hands to take action. Same with the National Election Commission, which is Fidesz dominated and has refused to even put it on the agenda to discuss. So it seems that those who are responsible and have the legal power, the competence to act, are not going to do it. And at the same time, I want to highlight again, journalists are doing their job. They're the ones who are uncovering these atrocities, really. And they're the ones who are going to be threatened. So I think it's very important to keep an eye on this aspect of this topic too. How can we protect journalists and civil society and other democratic actors?
Yeah, thank you so much. This extremely important point. Daniel.
Thank you so much. I just would like to piggyback on the argument of Mr. Hofreiter and underline the existence of a dilemma or emergence of a dilemma. And it is that we are experiencing a rising number of challenges that unfortunately cannot be addressed anymore in the framework of EU law, because they are simply outside of the framework of EU law. And it's a completely new challenge. We haven't seen that in the past, because even if it was far from being complete, we were in the position to address the violation of fundamental EU values, Article 2 values, via Article 7 procedure and infringement procedures, and so on. There was a way to address threats to the EU's financial interest in the form of strategic corruption. But how do you address the situation that a member of the Council of the European Union is wiring real-time sensitive information to an external challenger of the European Union, and practically being a Russian mole, absolutely in his official position, and this is even the expectation of his own government. And of course, you have the principle of sincere cooperation in the treaties, but what you don't really have in the treaties, how you can actually sanction and punish the violation of the principle of sincere cooperation. And here the real dilemma is that we are entering a phase when actually the European Union, in defense of the integrity of its own decision-making procedures, needs to respond politically to these challenges, because there is no other opportunity to do so. But the problem is, how will it actually impact the perception and the integrity of the EU decision-making if the EU starts to act and behave outside of the framework of EU law? And just the last phrase, that of course we cannot compare Hungary to anything. If you take a look on the annual VIDEM election or annual VIDEM democracy report that was published last week, then it's crystal clear that Hungary has been the top autocratizer in the extent of democratic backsliding over the past 16 years globally. But this phenomenon, what we see here, may not be only limited to Hungary. If I would like to provoke my Visegrad friends, then we can state that in 2027, Hungary might be the only Visegrad countries without any liberal government. We will have the French elections. So it's very difficult to find an answer that's not weakening the integrity of the European Union, but we need to find one because beyond Hungary, this might be a recurring challenge and it's our joint interest to find an answer to it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, Judith, please, you have another hand.
Thank you. I would like to just add two, three sentences. So I think there is one positive thing that there is now an evidence to support this knowledge that there is a Russian interference, because that was a knowledge for years that we had this influence. We knew that the system, the IT system of the foreign ministry was hacked several years ago. So now there is an evidence how things worked in this matter, and I think Marta was really right that Hungarian authorities and international authorities have now the responsibility to investigate what it really means.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think when we look at questions here, and the next question from the audience. So one is you know, about the tricks and all the things that Orbán might and Fidesz might need to use or will use on April the 12th to unfair, well, they are unfair, but to also unfree the election. So I will put that question by Sabine a bit on the back foot here, because the next one, I think Reinhold makes up something very important. He says that Hungary basically shows what we may expect in Germany of the AfD, so our far right and good friends of Orban, will actually win. Do you see that? Also, this is basically his proposition. So he asked the round, is that what do you agree with that? That is basically this is what happens if the far right is getting into power, and what can Europe do against it? So this is his provocation, I would say. And I actually want to add another point to it, and maybe also in the last 12 minutes we have. France was mentioned today just before the webinar started. Actually, the news came in that Giorgia Meloni failed with her referendum to amass more power for the Italian executive. So, and in the French elections on the weekend, there was actually, you know, the far right didn't actually capture any major towns or small ones. So there's a feeling that and Donald Trump's life is not that easy right now, I would say. And so as one question to answer specifically about, you know, is that where we go with when far right governments, but then more broadly, are we actually maybe seeing a little wave here where this autocratic project in Europe at least may come at a point where it's not going further, and actually people are fighting back and fighting back successfully like they did in France and in Italy? So maybe this to open this up. So Daniel and then Tony and then please also the others. Daniel.
Well, looking past the past 16 years, Orban was an example for many people. Anybody around Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, they were Hungarians. They were in Hungary. Some of them have Hungarian ancestors, and they checked how checks and balances can be cut. And what is the narrative that worked for Orban? And you have to see Project 2025, Donald Trump, his project last year. So there are so many parallels. How to cut the media's freedom, how to, you know, take over and spread rumors and fake news, and how to cut down, to slash democracy. And we see this is what's happening in a number of European countries, between Poland and Hungary. There was this development, Janez Janša in Slovenia. It's very openly saying that Fidesz is an inspiration, and also Fiso. So, and the AfD, you know, is blowing the same trumpet and commending Trump for what he's up to. And at the same time, those who do not agree, who do not think it's a good idea, they can learn from those who fought the autocrat system. So if Peter Magyar wins the election on April 12th, many eyes will be directed on him and to get inspiration on how to bring momentum into democracy in Europe. And I think Poland has been looked at, has been observed for a long while, because this has worked much better than in many other countries, like in Hungary, for example. And I believe that the essential role that civil society plays, that the judges play in the legal system, and also in Poland, we've seen women advocating their rights. They played a very important role. They were pioneers. So now, just looking at that question, what direction are things going to? I think that the elections in Hungary are so important because this will give us an idea as to what is going to happen elsewhere. So looking at the positive scenario when Orbán will no longer be in power, should Donald Trump lose the midterm elections, and it looks like that, at the end of the year, maybe there's a shimmer of hope that in the European Union, things will shift and that the right extreme parties, the enemies of the state, are still growing stronger in Europe. Well, this might come to an end. It's not a matter of course. It's clear that we can fight this development and it's our job to do so. Thank you. Well, with what Daniel just said, I think we should bear in mind that the AfD, as I observed them, they would actually turn a lot worse than what we've seen with Orban. I think these are hardcore fascists, the majority in the AfD. That's my personal opinion. So they would not just be German fascists, but fascists in Germany. Germany is a very powerful country, and this is why I believe that in Germany we have to be very careful, even more careful. But what we can do, all of us, is that we can learn from Hungary's and Poland's experience.
We're about to close, or going towards the end. So we have still a few questions. Someone here, Sabina, also mentioned the connection between JD Vance and CPAC, which is like, you know, a conservative action conference that has now, of course, also happened in Hungary on a regular basis, and those connections. But I want to open one question here to everyone that has been asked by Benjamin Meyer, and he asked, can we really be sure that Peter Magyar wants to restore the rule of law and the integrity of the system and not just take over the corrupt networks from the Orban clique and place own cronies there? That said, Benjamin says, I think it's great that Mr. Orban has to be afraid of someone again politically, but can we be sure that it will be better? And maybe to add to Benjamin's very good question, also, how can we make sure if we are not sure? Maybe anyone matter?
Well, I certainly cannot speak for either political party in Hungary, but I do read what they say. And I take it that Peter Magyar has actually evolved quite a lot when it comes to protecting the rule of law. Two years ago, when he projected himself onto the stage of political state in Hungary, I remember he said, the top issue is corruption, the rule of law. It's not a key issue. He was very dismissive of the idea. Obviously, he did come from a political background where the rule of law was set to be a weapon to attack Hungary's politics. These days, however, and this is, I think, a consistent position, he talks a lot about the rule of law, how it is important to build back institutions. Just today, in Mietekaza, he said, we will build back the system of checks and balances. We will build back the rule of law and plural democracy. So these are promises, of course, and these have to be, if he gets a chance, he will have to deliver on them. And obviously there's going to be a lot of obstacles. And we again have to look to Poland to see how that goes. But what is
what is
very
very
important
important
is
is
that
that the
the
rule
rule
of
of law
law
is
is
a
a
real
real
core
core pillar
pillar of
of
our
our
societies.
societies.
It
It
has
has
meaning.
meaning.
It
It
gives
gives
safety
safety
to
to
citizens,
citizens, to
to
every
every
actor,
actor, be
be
it
it
a
a
civil
civil
society
society
organization,
organization,
a
a
judge,
judge,
a
media
media
outlet,
outlet,
a
a private
private
business,
business,
a
a foreign
foreign tourist.
tourist.
It
It is
is essential
essential
for
for
us.
us.
And
And
so
so
this
this
has to
has to
be
be
really
really
monitored
monitored closely
closely
how this
building
building
that
that
happens.
happens.
And
And
there
there
are
are
ways
ways
that
that
the
the
European
European
Commission
commission
has
has already,
already,
specified
specified
in the
in the
infamous
infamous
rule
rule
of
of
law
law conditionality
conditionality
milestones.
milestones.
There
There
is
is
quite a
quite a
lot
lot
of
of
technical
technical
expectations
expectations
out
out
there,
there,
but
but
I
I
think
think
we
we
have
have
to
to
be
be
more
more
ambitious
ambitious
than
than
that
that
those
those
milestones
milestones
don't
don't cover
cover everything
everything
that
that
is
is
important
important
to
to
keep
keep
a
a
government
government
in
in
check.
check.
So we
So
have
we
to
have
make
to make sure
sure civil
civil
society
society
can
can
do
do
its
its
job,
job,
journalists
journalists
can
can
do
do
their
their
job,
job,
institutions
institutions
can
can
do
do
their
their
job,
job,
and
and
this
this
effectively
effectively
we
will
will
boil
boil
down
down
to
to how
how
resilient
resilient
we
we
are
are
as
as
individuals
individuals
and
and
as
as
groups
groups
in
in society,
society, and
and
whether
whether
we
we
will
will
be
be
given
given
what is
what is
often
often
said
said
enabling
enabling
space
space
to
to
act,
act.
rather
Rather
than
than
a
a
repressive
repressive
one.
one.
So
So
we
we
will
will
have
have
to
to
claim
claim
that
that
as
as
citizens.
citizens.
But
But
of
of
course,
course,
the
the
government
government
will
will
have
have
to
to
undo
undo
a
a
lot
lot
of
of
the
the
damage
damage
and
and
to
to
create
create
an
an
environment
environment
and a
and a
legal
legal
framework
framework
that
that
actually
actually
helps
helps
organizations,
organizations,
institutions
institutions
to
to
do
do
their
their
job.
job.
So
So
in
in
this
this
sense,
sense,
I
I
think
think
the
the
European
European
union
union
institutions
institutions
will
will
also
also
be
be
quite
quite
important
important
to
to
see
see
how
how
they
they
react.
react.
And
And
to
to
ensure
ensure
that
that
there's
there's
not
not
only,
only,
promises,
promises,
but
but
there
there
is
is
action
action
towards
towards
their
their
delivery.
delivery.
Thank you. Yeah, we've done a few webinars, quite a few, on protecting and strengthening civil society and this and the role of the European Union in it. That can be very strong. So it's a very, very important point. Daniel Hegedus, then Daniel Freund, and then Judith Zeisler for the close.
Thank you so much.
Daniel.
On the one hand, I would like to moderate expectations. Of course, a couple of things can be done with a simple legislative majority, but because state capture in a large extent was created in Hungary with a constitutional two-thirds supermajority, in that regard, simply the power and competences of a new, even opposition-led Hungarian government would be pretty limited. Notwithstanding this, I think we have a couple of what to watches, or at least one very big what to watches, on the basis of which we can decide how serious is potentially Peter Magyar about this mission. And it was clearly communicated even last year that the main intention of a Tisza government would be to join the European Public Prosecutor's Office during the first week of the new government. I think if that happens, it's a very clear sign that they take the mission seriously. If we will see excuses emerging right at the beginning of the new mandate, then I think our concerns can be justified. But I fully agree with Marty that Peter Magyar appeared to be extremely fast learner, lernfähig, over the past 2 years, and he turned to be a highly effective political entrepreneur and operator. And I think he understands that he could grow to be a leader of a larger democratic project. And at the beginning, a large part of the voter base of the old Hungarian opposition parties tolerated him and decided to cast their votes for him in order to allow a change in government. But if we take a look on other party systems in the region, and particularly the Polish one, I think if Peter Magyar has bigger ambitions than what that ambition can be, actually to collect the larger part of pro-democracy and pro-EU forces under the umbrella of a center-right large catch-all party. And if he sees some attractiveness in such a strategic project, he can only succeed if he takes actually the protection of rule of law, fundamental rights, and I would put it simply that way, liberal constitutionalism seriously, and we can all hope that he does.
Thank you very much, Daniel Freund.
Well, I'd say, other than Marta, Judith, and Daniel, I have enjoyed the luxury that I do not vote in Hungary. So I do not need to say whether I trust him or not. So what I can do is I can say, okay, it's okay to trust him, but maybe check on him anyway. And we will check, we will monitor this very carefully. You can see a regime change. Does he deliver? It's not about any old promise or announcement he made or that he comes up with legislative proposals. We will be looking at the implementation, what's happening tangibly. Is reality changing? It is only once this shift has happened, when rule of law is fully functioning again, we will tick this box and say, yes, we can trust the procedures and we can stop the infringement procedure. And Daniel just said, joining the European Prosecutor's Office, this is something Magyar announced, but democracy will be the big issue, I believe, because Tisza, the opposition party, has really basically, destroyed all other oppositions, no liberal democrats, the social democrats. They might try their hand at the election, but they do not stand any chance. So, okay, Peter Magyar might win, but he will need to revive Hungarian democracy after April 12th, having more or less put aside all other parties. So we as Greens need to take a good look as well. So of course, we'd be happy to have Peter Magyar win the elections and Orbán no longer in power, but Tisza is not a Green party. 45 minutes is what his speech was last Sunday. I listened to what Peter Magyar said, but he didn't say a word. Protection of the climate, the environment, green politics, and other issues like equal rights. I haven't heard anything, but I think this would be a good thing for Hungarian politics if we heard about that a little more.
Come in, because your hand went down again. You can have
yes,
the floor.
Yes, thank you. I just put it down. Yes, Daniel said the majority of the things that I wanted to mention. I just wanted to add one more thing that we shouldn't forget about the problems that people take seriously nowadays. So there was a real turning point in people thinking maybe 2 years ago that corruption was no more tolerated. And that was in the polls as well, that after problems like healthcare and standard of living, corruption become a major problem for people as well and not tolerated anymore. And this year, new polls on the problem maps of Hungarian people, I saw appearing rule of law as well for the first time. So I think there is a positive way of change. And sorry, in the Hungarian people's thinking as well. However, changing the institutional system is not only a question of will, but as Daniel already said, it's a question of a simple or a constitutional majority as well. So some of the institutions can't be changed without a simple majority of the parliament. So that's why the results of these elections will be very important.
Thank you very much. And the very last one, Toni Hofreiter, very quickly, because we are over time.
Very briefly, indeed. I think that independent of the election results and independent of what it TISA does when they win the election, we really need a functioning state, and we also need teeth for the European Union against its own internal adversaries. We need to find a way forward, and that's something that I expect of the federal government and the European Commission to really sharpen up the instruments. Thank you very much, Tony. And I would like to add, looking at Eurobarometer, then the Hungarians really approve of Europe and they feel as being part of the European family. They want to remain in the European Union. And I think it's not only a question of sharpening the instruments. We have a new quality here with governments working against each other above the heads of the people. And I think we should concentrate on the people and look forward to the 12th of April and wishing for and hoping for a positive result. And we will certainly extend our support also in the future if we can. Thank you very much for having been here in this webinar. We will not go for the Easter break yet. We will have another very interesting webinar coming up on Iran and on people in Israel and in other countries suffering in the vicinity of Iran. And it'll either be this Wednesday or next week early. And this is what I wanted to say before closing.